So I'm at the Dalhousie School of Public Health. There's no affiliation to the rather famous Buddhist monk.
Oh, I'm sorry, my mistake.
That's okay. It's actually quite common. And that's the exact people are like, wow, that's incredible. And then and I'm like, no, they're just real estate agents in Toronto. So
I thought it was weird, but what do I know?
I'm a graduate student, so I wish I had financial interests. So what I'm going to be talking about today very briefly is about sort of when public policy and standards kind of go awry or against the best wishes or best intentions of the practitioners. And what I want to talk about is what are some of the reasons perhaps why this occurs and what might we do to actually combat what might be some perceived reasons for policy and standards that disadvantage disadvantaged populations. So I'll just briefly just introduce what are some traditional public health ethics values or public health values. I'll talk about three cases that I think sort of illustrate when populations who are marginalized or vulnerable, whatever language you want to use, are further marginalized through public health policy. What are some possible reasons and then some recommendations. So as many or all of you know here in this room, there are a variety of theories of public health and public health ethics and the values that underpin it. We hear, even from the opening remarks at the general opening session on Sunday, the word social justice comes out. It means different things to different people. Here are just sort of some theories that I thought of and some people that just kind of came to mind off the top of my head. But what's important about this notion of social justice in public health is that it underpins or motivates a lot of the research that has been conducted and is being conducted in public health, and a lot of the practice guidelines that we have are with the sort of the guiding value of social justice, right? So when we look at or we talk about social determinants of health, homelessness, global health, mental health, HIV/AIDS, there's always this social justice component to it. There's this underlying value of public health there. What I want to just briefly talk about is that sometimes these policies and practices within public health tend to disadvantage people that are previously marginalized or vulnerable, and I understand those are very tricky words. And that they're contested. I'm just going to assume that we have a common sense understanding of what those mean. And so the question is why? And are there certain commonalities between these examples that we can identify? So the first case is pandemic influenza and homelessness. I don't know about you, but there were countless pandemic plans domestically, internationally, across sectors, to the point where it was almost too many. And a lot of them contained helpful tips, and they were helpful tips. For example, if you have the flu, in Toronto there'd be posters with these. You stay at home, avoid crowds, wash your hands. So the question is, if you're homeless or you're precariously housed, what does it mean to stay at home? What does it mean to avoid crowds when you rely on shelters and you have infrequent access to water and soap? So then I did a brief, just very brief look on Google to look for pandemic plans that were at least in some measure talked about homeless populations. And then I sort of cross-referenced with homelesshub.ca, which is a really good resource if you guys don't know about just papers looking at different aspects of homelessness. So I came up with 11, Canada, U.S., St. Lucia. One report consulted with stakeholders or clients. So this is from the pandemic plan geared directly towards homeless persons working with homeless populations in Toronto. And I just want to look just for the food services, and this is just an example, I'm not picking on Toronto, but it says during influenza pandemic, community living settings should reinforce routine food safety and sanitation practices. Okay. Facilities should also consider the following, and just want to draw your attention to the bottom three. So, okay, use disposable cutlery and pre-packaged food if staffing levels are low. Consider stockpiling a 6 to 8 week supply of non-perishable food in case delivery of food is disrupted. if regular services are interrupted, plan for alternative food supplies. So the thing is, I don't know how it is in different cities, but in Toronto, the food banks are sort of living day to day. And the shelters and soup kitchens are themselves have maybe a day or two worth of resources available to them. So although this is well-intentioned, the question is, to what extent can this apply? Here's another example from Indiana State. Again, I'm not picking, but just to show. So the question was, if an influenza pandemic were to occur, how should the homeless be notified and cared for? So the very first thing they say is, homeless people should not be encouraged to come to shelters. Again, the logic, I chuckle too, but the logic behind it makes sense, right? You want to avoid crowds. I mean, there's good infectious disease control reasons why you want to do that. But, you know, my doctoral research is in tuberculosis. I'll talk about that in a moment. But when you're talking about things like TB and in other infectious diseases, the question is, or with persons who are homeless or have other comorbidities, the question is, you have to balance these infectious diseases with what's underlying. So maybe being out in the cold, and I presume that Indiana is quite cold in the winter, maybe that's not the best thing to do. Maybe you're better off going to a shelter despite the risk of transmission. So case two, smoking in persons with schizophrenia. We're at a public health conference, so I don't have to tell everyone. Please say hello. The smoking's ill effects are well known, right? So everybody knows that. Persons with schizophrenia, you might also know this, smoke at a higher rate and smoke more per day than individuals who don't have a diagnosis of schizophrenia. What's less known and less talked about is that there's some science that suggests that there's some benefit to smoking cigarettes for persons with schizophrenia. So there's neurological benefits, including some evidence that suggests there's improved cognition, help with auditory and visual control, and that there's some social benefit to smoking, insofar as one study said that it was a sign of retaining freedom at moments when persons with schizophrenia don't have freedom, so if they're in a mental health center. And it's also a way of forming relationship for people that are often in social isolation. So that is, they form bonds in these sort of organic moments when they're outside smoking or they're smoking with others. So within the U.S., Canada, and the U.K., many mental health centers have institutional bans on indoor smoking. And again, it makes a lot of sense. The justification for this is based on the harm of secondhand smoke, and that's often based on the invocation of a harm principle. And so the harm principle, just really colloquially, just means you can do whatever you want as long as it doesn't interfere with other people. Again, very, very rough. There's a case out of the UK, the second bullet point there, where clients who were long-term clients of a mental health center in the UK took to court the NHS Trust, arguing that the mental health center that they were at, the psychiatric facility they were at, actually functioned as their private dwelling, and that laws banning indoor smoking actually went against their human right under the human rights codes in the EU. And the court, it's a very interesting case if you have a chance to read it, the court upheld the law that allowed to have smoking bans indoors. But what was interesting is it actually went further than just upholding the ban, and they said similar things to what's there on the slide, namely, there's no general right of mental patients to smoke or general obligation to permit smoking. Now, remember that I said that the justification for indoor smoking bans is justified, and perhaps rightfully so, on the basis of the harm principle. So that is, it's harm to other individuals besides those engaging in the act of smoking. But the question is, what about, and I'm just going to assume that there's a right to self-regulate and self-medicate. There's a right to do things that are beneficial to yourselves, although they might be on the balance somewhat harmful. Okay. So the question is, what of this notion of reciprocity, what of this perhaps right that we have to benefit our own bodies or to conduct activities that benefit our bodies? So case three. Tuberculosis is a person with severe mental illness. So TB is an airborne pathogen, bacterial pathogen, affects persons of lower SES primarily. That includes persons with severe and persistent mental illness, severe mental illness, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, and bipolar disorder. The treatment includes antituberculum medication, and from a public health point of view, isolation, what's called directly observed therapy. That is when you actually watch an individual with tuberculosis swallow the medication. So the isolation and the DOT are done as measures to enhance public health so that you're not spreading the actual tuberculosis. The question is there a conflict with isolation and DOT relative to the goals of mental health care? Maybe yes, maybe no, and I'll just say this is actually what my thesis is looking at, and it's very complicated, as you would expect. There's some evidence that at least two of the antituberculum medications have side effects or contraindicated in persons with psychosis, and that the goal of mental health writ large, and especially community mental health, which is, I guess, the push, and things like assertive community treatment and intensive case management, it's to reduce social isolation. That is, to get people to form bonds and relationships and to become sort of autonomous individuals. So this is just one example from the WHO, wrote a document in 2006 on Stop TB. So regarding the use of cyclosporin, which is a second-line drug, meaning that it's used in cases of multi-drug-resistant or extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, in the actual document, at one point it says it's contraindicated, another point says there's adverse events, so there's a bit of contradiction within the document. But it says, it does say at one point, the benefits of using this cyclosporin drug may outweigh the potentially higher risks of adverse events. Well, for whom? Cyclosporin should be discontinued, quote, if this can be done without compromising TB regimen. Well, then it raises the question, well, so what of the person suffering of psychosis? So from a public health point of view, it definitely makes sense that you want to stop the spread of TB. And if you're using cyclosporin, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, then it's a very dangerous form of tuberculosis if you're using this drug. So again, the WHO's recommendation isn't outrageous, but there might be this notion, there might be a lack of perspective that wasn't taken. 2 minutes? Oh, well. Okay. So, possible reasons, and I'll fly by these. So, one is the problem of reversing positions, and I'm taking this from Iris Young, and you can read the quotes there. The notion is she challenges, and I think correctly so, I'm just going to present it, I'm not going to defend it, the notion that that the notion of putting yourself in somebody else's shoes might not be possible for metaphysical reasons or epistemological reasons, and that this actually has an important political component. That is, the notion of, oh, well, I know I can put myself in somebody else's shoes. Another possible reason is things that are either irrefutably good or irrefutably bad. So, the question is irrefutably good or bad for whom? Under what conditions? Could something that's good or bad be sometimes kinda bad or good under certain conditions? There's issues of time constraints, so we see this a lot in pandemics or infectious diseases. And the last point is this notion of utilitarianism or bust. And I say utilitarianism in air quotes because there's this notion of maximizing the good. That it's not necessarily a bad thing, it's a good thing, but it's sometimes very glib and uninformed and very simplistic. And so that may also be a reason that's generating these policies and situations. So recommendations. Public stakeholder and consultation dialogue. This is growing in importance and recognition. So just the session previously that I went to was on community-based participatory research. So this is going on, and I would say there's good important metaphysical and epistemological reasons why we want to do this, apart from sort of deliberative democracy reasons that are sort of used to being considered. This, to me, is key, the evaluating the normative assumptions that underpin policy and practice. So I would argue that there needs to be a greater emphasis on teaching what I'm just calling critical thinking, but really just the basics of argumentation and philosophy of science in public health as part of public health curriculum. And the goal isn't to make people public health science, philosophy of science experts, but merely just to whet their appetite, to get them thinking about some of the assumptions that underpin what it is we do every day. And then finally, if we combine these two, planning ahead. So it's good to have pandemic plans, it's good to have planning in general, but do so in consultation with stakeholders and while evaluating normative assumptions. So I'm sure you can read all my references. And I'd just like to say thank you to the Canadian Institutes of Health Research and Lupina Foundation for funding, and Sally Bean, Max Smith, and Ross Upshur for their helpful comments. Thank you.